so that the child is confident that nothing bad is going to happen. Part of the freedom to alter the natural order of things, let's say this car can fly, let's throw all the Legos in a big pile on the floor and see what we can make from them, is the knowledge that order will be restored again afterward. Preschool kids may not want to stop playing and clean up, but if every day at 10 a.m. they are told in a non-judgmental, non-angry way that it's time to clean up and a game is made of it, they will feel the emotional logic of reasonable boundaries, and within this consistency, find comfort. It is a wonder to watch someone who is really good at balancing children's simultaneous but opposing needs for supervision and freedom, for order and disorder. My friend Mindy Upton is one such wonderful teacher. She runs Blue Sky, a preschool in Boulder, Colorado, where the kids have a lot of structure, but they are free within that structure. Mindy, like the best teachers and caregivers, can make a game of anything. There is joy, evident even in the cleanup. Good teachers like Mindy also provide inspiring rituals that match the seasons or ages of the children. In many tribes, the role of providing order and freedom is assigned to the grandmothers. They are not as harried as other adults, and so they can take the time to let children express themselves, but they have enough experience to set safe limits. Even in our society, grandparents are often the ones who have the time to really listen to children. Parents are often busy trying to mold a child into what they think he or she ought to be. Perhaps grandparents are the ones who see us for what we really are and help us grow into that. I remember distinctly my own grandfather taking me out driving in the countryside when I was 10, then pulling over and switching places so that I could try driving a little. Sometimes he would awaken me before dawn, take me into a small town for a pancake meal, and then take me out to a field where he showed me how to safely handle a gun. There was a sense of discovery and wonder when he presented me with his .22 semi-automatic, a gun that kept him alive for a winter when he was poor. Real guns were taboo at that age, but he gave me permission to be something other than my parents' expectations, which, though not overbearing, were nonetheless more constricted than his. Perhaps this grandparental dividend is why we live so long. Long enough to become grandparents, while other animals die soon after the reproductive years end. Once kids enter school, the importance of free play doesn't end. All of the patterns that induce states of play are present and remain important for growth, flexibility, and learning. Unfortunately, we often forget this, or choose not to focus on play's necessity under intense pressure to succeed. No Child Left Behind is a perfect example. While it is an admirable and even necessary goal to make sure that all children attain a certain minimal level of education, the result has often been a system in which students are provided a rote, skills and drills approach to education, and non-essential subjects like art and music are cut. In many school districts, even recess and physical education have been severely reduced or even eliminated. The neuroscience of play has shown that this is the wrong approach, especially considering that students today will face work that requires much more initiative and creativity than the rote work this educational approach was designed to prepare them for. In a sense, they are being prepared for 20th century work, assembly line work, in which workers don't have to be creative or smart. They just have to be able to put their assigned bolt in the assigned hole. In fact, Jacques Poncep suggests that depriving young animals of play might delay or disrupt brain maturation. In particular, his research shows that play reduces the impulsivity normally seen in rats with damage to their brain's frontal lobes, a type of damage thought to model human attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, because it affects executive functions such as self-control. Ponksepp has also performed research studies on normal rats, comparing the brains of those that have just had a major play session with the brains of those deprived of it. In both settings, he and his student Nikki Gordon have found evidence that play increases gene expression in the frontal lobe for brain-deprived neurotrophic factor, BDNF, a protein thought to be involved with brain maturation. Without play, Ponksepp suggests, optimal learning, normal social functioning, self-control, and other executive functions may not mature properly. This research has led him to propose a connection between a lack of rough-and-tumble play and ADHD. In fact, based on their findings that abundant access to rough-and-tumble play reduces the inappropriate hyperplayfulness and impulsivity of rats with frontal lobe damage, he and his colleagues proposed that a regimen of social, boisterous play might be one way to help children with mild to moderate ADHD control impulsivity. And it also is good for those not necessarily prone to ADHD. Learning and memory. Learning itself is enhanced by play, as many teachers know, which is why classrooms often use role play or simulation to teach a subject that is difficult or perceived to be boring. Kids think history is dry as bone if they are forced to memorize dates and names, but let them play a game of diplomacy or imagine themselves living on the frontier in colonial times, and history comes alive. Really good teachers also know when to use humor and irony to get lessons across. My late Uncle Bruce taught middle school science, social studies, and math in Greeley, Colorado. He would wear a duck call to the first day of class, and when asked what it was, said, "It's a secret, and has secret powers." Over the next weeks, he would discuss duck ecology, migrating patterns, and so on as part of the curriculum, continually wearing the duck call, but never using it. Then, on the opening day of duck season, he would station his son outside the class with a bunch of tame but wild-looking mallard ducks. Without warning, my uncle would put the call to his lips, blow as if playing a fanfare, "Ack! Ack! Ack!" while his son threw the mallards into the classroom through an open window. 30 years later, the head of the Colorado and Pacific Crest Outward Bound Schools, who was a member of this class, still remembers the migration patterns of mallards, their winter habitat, and many other details that students of less gifted teachers probably learned but have long forgotten. Some may cheapen these methods by saying that these teachers are just entertaining students, but what is wrong with that? As long as the lessons are learned as well or better than they would be with other methods. Play isn't the enemy of learning. It's learning's partner. Play is like fertilizer for brain growth. It's crazy not to use it. As we grow older, we are taught that learning should be serious, that subjects are complicated. These serious subjects take serious study, we are told, and play only trivializes them. And yet, learning all the complications of a subject first can be confusing and dispiriting. You may like music and like the sounds you can get out of a piano, but are told that first you have to learn the diatonic scale cold. Sometimes the best way to get the feel of a complicated subject is just to play with it. That's why kids often learn computer systems faster than adults. They aren't afraid to just try stuff out and see what works, whereas adults worry that they will do something wrong. Kids don't fear doing something wrong. If they do, they learn from it and do it differently next time. Learning in memory also seem to be fixed more strongly and last longer when learned in play. While this can be objectified in animal tests, it is also a reasonable hypothesis for humans based on performance and outcome results in a variety of educational settings. The link between adequate recess time and later higher performance is one finding that appears to support these benefits. This may be because of the total involvement that play often requires. The state of play is one in which attention is focused exclusively on the pleasurable play activity, and memory fixation has been shown to be closely related to heightened attention and emotional rewards. In addition, play involves multiple centers of perception and cognition across the whole brain. As psychologist Stephen Civi, my colleague and National Institute for Play Science advisor, says, play just lights everything up in the brain of rats at play. Civi has shown how bouts of play particularly affect the brain's levels of certain intermediate early genes, CFOS genes, that foster neuronal excitability and survival. Civi was surprised by the extent of the activation of these genes in the prefrontal cortices of playing rats. He speculates that by strengthening connections between brain areas that might be weakly connected previously, play enhances the retention of knowledge. The power of playfulness during learning was grasped long ago by the creators of Sesame Street, which has become the longest-running children's show in the United States. In 1969, a group of people interested in creating an educational television program decided to deliver lessons the same way companies sold products, in short, catchy, and memorable segments that were consciously made to resemble commercials. They used humor that appealed to children, but their parodies of popular culture also attracted adults. The producers originally meant to have separate puppet segments and live-action street scenes, but tests showed that audiences were less interested in scenes that only included humans. But they found that if puppets and people were in a scene together, the humans could deliver all sorts of practical messages without losing children's interest. The mixture of fantasy and real, jokes and lessons, has been an effective and winning combination for over 4 decades now, spawning billions in business, launching many successful feature movies, and attracting guest stars who range from Johnny Cash to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Gifts of Play. Here's a scene that parents around the world have witnessed over and over. It's a second or third birthday, and the big present comes out. The excited birthday boy or girl tears into the wrapping to uncover the box, then opens the box to find the perfect gift that the parent has worked so hard to find. Maybe it's the hottest toy on the planet, the one you have to put yourself on a list to get. Perhaps it's a car or doll that has special significance to the parents, one that they had themselves when they were young. Or it could be a heirloom, the actual tin truck or porcelain doll that grandpa or grandma had. Imagine the family chagrin then when their little darling is more interested in playing with the box than the toy. Parents should be happy about such a turn of events. It shows that their child has developed a healthy play drive, one that comes from their own fantasies and desires. The box is a blank slate, something they can transform through imagination into anything they want. As they grow, kids are often taught out of this imaginative approach to play, at first by parents, who might impart pressure and guilt that they really should be playing with this great toy, or by pervasive media marketing. Later, kids get toys that come straight out of hit movies or TV shows, toys that come with a preset collection of ideas about who the characters are and how children should play with the toys. This kind of preformed script can rob the child of the ability to create his own story. Instead, he is mimicking the expressions and lines that he is expected to say. A chance for imaginative flights of fancy is lost. Authentic play comes from deep down inside us. It's not formed or motivated solely by others. Real play interacts with and involves the outside world, but it fundamentally expresses the needs and desires of the player. It emerges from the imaginative force within. That's part of the adaptive power of play. With a pinch of pleasure, it integrates our deep physiological, emotional, and cognitive capacities. And quite without knowing it, we grow. We harmonize the influences within us. Where we may have felt pulled in one direction by the heart and another direction by the head, play can allow us to find a balanced course or a third way. All evidence indicates that the greatest rewards of play come when it arises naturally from within. When play arises out of innate motivations, it is also likely time to occur when we are primed for the most synaptic neural growth. That is when we are embracing the issues that grab us most, the ones we may not even be able to voice logically. Our desires and needs are preconscious, inchoate, and the act of play gives them form and breathes life into them. This process is easier to see in the young, but occurs throughout life. You can see it in the glee that a young boy gets from watching a fire truck go by, and then see it once again as he voices his urgent need to go to the fire station, get a toy fire truck, or put out imagined fires on the family room floor. We may think we are helping to prepare our kids for the future when we organize all their time. When we continually ferry them from one adult-organized, adult-regulated activity to another. And of course, to some degree, these activities do promote culturally approved behavior, as well as reinforce our roles as good parents. But in fact, we may be taking from them the time they need to discover for themselves their most vital talents and knowledge. We may be depriving them of access to an inner motivation for an activity that will later blossom into a motive force for life. It used to be that self-organized play was all kids did. Most adults over the age of 45 will likely have memories of exploring on their own, through puddles and fields or on city streets. The only direction they got from their parents was to be home for dinner or before dark. The pickup games of my own youth were typical of those that spontaneously cropped up in vacant lots and parks across the country. They were anarchic and didn't always end well, but they had their own style and etiquette, were full of interruptions, reversals, flexibilities, and rule changes. Despite the seeming anarchy, these games existed within an overall, agreed-upon sense of structure and fairness. They were undertaken with an accepted, minimal risk of damage, and had safeguards. Although there was considerable mayhem and noise during the course of these games, I remember that they were exciting, and there wasn't naked aggression. These games certainly let me know who I was. Feisty, vulnerable, a fairly fast and shifty runner, but not as gutsy a tackler or as courageous a blocker as my brother. I needed his protection, and that of his friends to take on the challenge of the games, and they freely offered it. It was terribly important to get in the game and belong. I remember feeling fierce. But it was okay to cry if you got hurt. Not okay to cheat or whine. Not okay to make fun of one of your own team members, but okay to ridicule someone on the other team. If team members changed in the middle of the game, it was then okay to try to verbally humiliate the former teammate. After these games, we discussed the big plays, the great plays, the incredibly lucky plays. We had our own verbal highlights reels, letting kids shine for a few moments in the spotlight for their abilities. We also let the screw-ups know their deficiencies in clear language. I can attest that these child-organized, child-dominated experiences have had major effects on not only my own capabilities and perceptions as an adult, on how I grew to see myself, but did so also for all the other boys who were involved in these games. Dougie Weaver was a star and became a Big Ten halfback and later a major coach. The other star, Lenny Keith, faded athletically as he started high school, but his academic interests and tinkering nature led him into dentistry. Looking back now, these play-inspired portraits of me and others feel more real, persistent, and predictive of life to come than any other molding experience. Certainly, parents and mentors are pivotal, but the self that emerges through play is the core, authentic self. Alas, these kinds of activities are becoming rarer. Most suburban kids now are ferried from music lesson to math tutor to soccer game. Every activity is organized and overseen by adults. This is not all bad. I think that in many ways the relationship between kids and adults, kids and their parents, is much closer than in my day. But something very significant has also been lost. My last trip to suburban Chicago and the old neighborhood revealed no empty lots, no pickup games, a lot of adult-supervised youth sports, busy kids and parents, many more and much nicer cars, less street noise, clearer air, mixed ethnic groups in sidewalk restaurants, and multiple families living in the big Victorian houses. Not the same world. Talk to kids on the street. When they can be found, they are usually leaping from a car to their next adventure, and they are generally more hip, glib, and inevitably texting and on cell phones, and are more comfortable with adults than I remember any of my gang of buddies. On the other hand, I believe that by the age of 10 or 11, kids, even on the soccer and little league fields today, create their own private play domains, which may seem like just goofing off when the coach isn't looking. Nature's design for play is just too strong to be pushed aside completely. They will find their own new ways of asserting their own community, socialization patterns, and individuality. One journalist recently wrote about driving his kids and their friends from one activity to another when he noticed a strange giggling among the group in back. Upon further inquiry, he discovered that they were all texting one another on their cell phones so that they could speak frankly, but secretly, in the presence of the adult. They were creating their own private play zone where they could socialize freely. It's easy to start to worry about risks when kids create their own play. What are the kids texting each other when they don't want me to hear? Is it profanity? Inappropriate sexual talk? Are they hurting someone? Or, if I let them freely roam, are they going to ride their bike in the pathway of a car? Will they drown in the pond? Start taking drugs? These are the kinds of questions that parents have wrestled with since antiquity, and they will probably continue to do so into eternity. But part of being a parent is learning to accept the limitations of our ability to make our kids safe, successful, and happy. We should strive for all these things, but eventually they will grow and learn to be on their own, we all hope. All parents need to foster that internally driven, self-directed play that will allow children to become secure and self-confident on their own. There are risks to this sort of play, and the risks should be monitored and minimized. But trying to suppress free play or rigidly control kids' activities poses, in my long-term experience, a far greater risk to their future health, success, and happiness. Coming into adulthood. Sophomoric rites of adolescence. The Greeks perfectly captured the paradox of adolescence in the term sophomore, which literally means wise foolish. In adolescence, kids are pulled in opposite, incompatible directions. They are torn apart. Adolescents are expected to take on adult responsibilities and yet not given adult privileges. They can be amazingly perceptive, sometimes even more so than the adults in their lives, and yet they can still make the most fantastically colossal errors of judgment. In the end, The goal of adolescence is not only to acquire the skills to thrive in a world in which we are mutually dependent, but also to acquire a sense of individuality and uniqueness. Kids have the task of separating themselves from their parents while maintaining a close and affectionate relationship. No wonder it is a difficult and confusing time. In order to do this, adolescents grow a new brain. I exaggerate only a little. Neuroscientists have shown that during puberty, a whole new set of brain genes that have been silent since birth turn on, creating a flowering of new neural growth and pruning of the cortical neuronal trees at a level unmatched since our early development in the womb. As the neural tangle works itself out, kids can see the world in unique and surprising ways. Studies have demonstrated that adolescents who are shown pictures of various facial expressions will often make very odd and wrong inferences about the emotions the people in the picture are feeling. Because of these odd perceptions of everyday stimuli, teens in some way are living in a different reality from the rest of us. And it doesn't just happen during the teens. This brain growth continues well into the 20s. This is especially significant as our society extends adolescence out beyond the traditional high school years. The adolescent period often is a time in which kids are pushed to be serious, to put away childish things, and prepare for the adult world. And yet, I would say that learning how to stay playful in age-appropriate ways while taking on those responsibilities is one of the most important tasks of this age. What does that mean, really? How is it possible to remain playful when so much must be done? Kids have homework to complete, chores, sports programs. In many families, there are also jobs after school, responsibilities at church or temple functions, or other family obligations. Some kids, when asked if they are overloaded, will look at this list and say, check, check, check to all of the above. The need for kids to work hard and achieve, while at the same time playing and finding their own joy, comes to a head for many families as the kids get close to college age. This is never an easy or simple subject to address. Parents feel responsible for providing the best opportunities possible for their kids, providing a prime education, and helping them to accumulate an impressive resume by the end of the junior year in high school is the norm for many families. However, this pattern is normal but not healthy, as my playful friend Dr. Bowen White says. What are the alternatives? I advise allowing wisely guided personal choice, initiated by your child. Provide plenty of environmental opportunities early, starting much earlier than high school, and encourage early play patterns that have risen directly from the natural choices that your child's early play demonstrates. The parents of Jillian Lynn, the dancer and choreographer, spotted an early talent that at first looked like a big problem, and encouraged it. Parents and educators, corporate leaders, and others need to become convinced by the evidence that long-term life skills and a rewarding sense of fulfillment, and yes, performance, are more the byproduct of play-related activities than forced performance. True mastery over a lifetime comes from one's internal play compass. When parents and teachers push too hard to get kids to perform, children do not experience feelings of competence and do not create from within their own sense of mastery. Whether the pressure to get into a premier college is prompted by parental ambition, cultural pressures, or economic necessity to remain upwardly mobile, the result is that many high school kids give up everything they enjoy in the pursuit of resume perfection. Harvard alumnus Michael Weinrip writes about interviewing a bright young applicant to Harvard for the school's admission committee. Despite the student's 4.0 GPA, high SAT score, volunteer work in the local hospice, foregoing summer vacation to teach reading at the local prison, etc., etc., in other words, a perfect resume, this would be another kid who most likely wouldn't be admitted because there are so many of these perfect kids applying. Parents know this, and the expectation is to be even more perfect. The pressure on these kids is extreme. The New York Times recently published an article on a high school where kids were going without lunch in order to maximize their academic credits as a means of adding to their credentials for admission. As an article in Slate stated recently, those who play the game most intensively are often rewarded. The child who takes 15 AP courses, plays the clarinet in 3 orchestras, runs a Cambodian refugee camp in the summer, and eschews lunch all winter really does have a better chance of getting into college than the child who plays kickball after school in the empty lot next door. What this demonstrates is the lack of appreciation for what freely chosen play-based activities contribute to long-term life satisfaction. For a dozen years, I have been presenting a seminar on play every fall to a group of pre-selected Stanford sophomores, followed by their participation in a 2-week leadership immersion. Something I have noticed is how consistently bright these students all are, but as admission to Stanford has become more competitive in recent years, I have also noticed that their sense of autonomy has diminished. They appear, to me at least, to initiate less and less spontaneous joy than in years past. They seem to be in command of more information, combined with a consistent radar homing them to be pleasing to the professors. With a few exceptions, they are, in my opinion, suffering from chronic low-grade play deprivation, and are so used to their hectic, pressured, high-performance lives, despite still being kids, that they don't realize what they have missed in pursuit of academic excellence and success. Perhaps a healthier trend is being set by Naperville School District 203 in Illinois. In his groundbreaking book, Spark, John Rady writes how Madison Junior High School physical education director Phil Lawler started a revolution in the school's approach to physical education. The model developed in Naperville focuses on aerobic exercise and lifelong fitness, giving kids the skills and experiences necessary to lead physically active lives. The school takes an individual approach, encouraging each student to progress toward his or her personal fitness goals. Students engage in a wide variety of physically strenuous play, involving traditional games and activities, as well as more novel play activities, such as climbing walls, Dance Dance Revolution, and a video game-like interactive stationary bike course simulator. PE for Life, a not-for-profit organization dedicated to promoting quality physical education in U.S. schools, has adopted the Naperville model and is now exporting it by setting up PE for Life academies in schools around the country. By allowing choice of activities, they are introducing play as an integral dimension of academic programs. Naperville's District 203 High School has been opening up new vistas by continuing the middle school programs, modified for older kids. Academic performances have increased dramatically as fitness has improved. Phil Lawler started by introducing cardiovascular fitness, even to non-athletes, and was surprised to see grades going up. As the health and academic successes began to accumulate, more playful activities have been introduced, all very active, including square dancing. So instead of padding their resumes with more academic courses and shunning PE, Naperville has, in my judgment, combined hard physical activity with academics and play. While monitoring cardiac fitness is a major component of these programs, the evidence is overwhelming that by allowing kids to choose their activity, it does have to be hard aerobic exercise. The kids are having fun, improving their bodies and also their brain function. I think it is important for kids to keep a sense of perspective. It is important to recognize that taking care of responsibilities, getting good grades in schools, and all the other team duties are important, but they are not the be-all and end-all of life. These things are all paradoxically important, but not important. This sense of having a little distance, a sense of irony, is what gets us through the hard times. Adults can model these qualities and improve their own life in the process. By a sense of irony, I don't mean cynicism, which comes out of a darker view of the world. I mean the kind of ironic view that allows kids to laugh at themselves and the often ridiculous world they live in. Whenever I see a kid with a strong sense of irony, I think, that kid is probably going to be okay. A playful attitude about life, not really taking everything like popularity or competitive academics or adult criticism so deeply seriously, is key, while at the same time tending to the necessities of growing up, staying within boundaries of the law, taking no inordinate risks, avoiding addictions, and so on. I would recommend a rarely read but classic book here, Joseph Meeker's The Comedy of Survival, as a prime text for orienting adolescents and adults to a non-idealized world. A great exercise that I often used for both kids and adults was to ask them to visualize their lives 5 or 10 years in the future, focusing not on whether they want to be a lawyer or be rich, but instead on what they might be doing that would make them really happy and excited. This itself is a kind of imaginative play. It allows people to step out of their everyday life and see the bigger picture. It also allows them to see clearly how they really want their lives to be, to focus on those elements that arise out of the true core self, rather than on what the world wants them to be. Once people have this sort of vision, they are empowered to move toward making it a reality. I think that nobody should keep an iron-fisted grip on any particular vision. As with any play activity, people need to be open to improvisation and serendipity. Remember that the point of this exercise is not to create a 5 or 10 year plan for personal development. The point is to clarify who you are and what sort of future speaks to you emotionally. The most rewarding activities and interests come to light when we open ourselves up to them. Goals are good, but overly rigid pursuit of those goals can inhibit growth and understanding. After discovering what appeals to us emotionally, the strongest emotions, or those that resonate most, lead to the creation of a realistic path forward. Bill Gates left Harvard because he loved computers. Nate Jones, who showed the importance of hand play to JPL, liked cars. Oprah recognized her talents and grew with them. Ozzie Smith, the retired baseball star, as a kid threw balls over the roof and chased them down, imagining himself in the majors. These were emotion-laden choices, not cognitively laid out 10-year plans. Although I think that sports and other adult organized activities can be overdone, sports can be a potent training for a playful life during the teen years. Sports provide a ready peer group, united in a common goal. Sports teach how to struggle against adversity, even when the odds seem insurmountable. Adult organized sports don't have to be anti-play when they are done right. When I think of model sports programs, I often think of a coach, Gary Avicius, who coaches hockey for 6 to 9 year olds. He puts his team together randomly. He doesn't just recruit for talent, and as a result gets a real mix of abilities. He starts kids out not with games, but on rollerblades, skating on sidewalks and empty parking lots around town with their hockey sticks over their heads. He has them skate on a hill with a lawn so they can fall down and not hurt themselves. They have fun and learn to skate around objects and skate backward. This allows them to build their skills, but it also allows Gary to get a feeling for the kids' personalities and spot the ones who need extra help. they also do exercises that bring the kids together as a team. When they finally do get in the rink, they don't use a puck, but a midget football. It's almost impossible to control, so that they can get the feeling for moving and passing, but don't feel shamed if they mess up. When they do use the puck, they are more used to passing and find the puck much easier to control. They are required to pass the puck multiple times before they try a shot on goal during the scrimmage. By this point in the training, the kids have come to realize that all they are ever going to get from their coach is positive feedback. By the time they are finally ready to play actual games, they have learned to work together as a team with energy and skill, and look forward to the fun of competition. The recognition of personal improvement, not stardom, is the gauge for mutual respect. The result is that Gary's teams have won the championship in their area for 13 of the past 15 years. But more important than that, win or lose, the kids love to play. I went to a banquet after the championship game one year when they did not win. Both Gary's team and the championship team were at the banquet sitting at an adjoining table. The contrast between the two teams was remarkable. Gary's team was having a great time, laughing and joking, while the other team was more subdued, serious-looking, its members not looking as if they were enjoying their championship win. The winning coach was pretty hardcore for this age group, always wearing a tie and putting up with no silliness, running the team through skills and drills constantly. They were winners, but anyone looking at the two teams would have thought that Gary's kids were the champions. Indeed, when the waiter came up to Gary's team, he asked them how it felt to win the trophy. They happily told him they had lost. Athletics provide feedback about one's own physical talents and what it feels like to participate, win, lose, and be fair. And because sporting contests are games, because the outcome doesn't, or shouldn't, materially affect our well-being, they give us perspective on the other struggles we have in life. No wonder our society is sports-obsessed. William Bowen, a former president of Princeton University, once did a large statistical study to determine if the special preferences that athletes got on college admissions, lower SAT score cutoff, extra financial aid, were unfair. Bowen was surprised to find that, as a group, the athletes actually did better financially after college than other students, a fact he attributed to the drive and energy that sports cultivate. Other studies have demonstrated better mental health later in life among those who have participated in sports, not necessarily varsity level, at college age. Although, as a society, we often focus on sports as an essential group character-building activity of childhood, there are many other arenas in which teens can build a constructive peer group. Speech and debate, drama, math club, art, band, and orchestra also provide a forum for play and exploration among groups of like-minded kids. Home-built computer clubs used to be big 30 years ago, and now robotics are a big deal among kids in Silicon Valley. The competitions are incredible, which is just another example of how the toys of today become the technology of tomorrow. From child to adult. The rites of passage in making the transition from adolescent to adult entail certain changes. Rites of passage involve achieving a sense of self, which brings with it a sense of confidence. They involve breaking away from the norm, making one's own path, facing adversity, and contributing a boon to society. In mythology, the returning hero not only comes back more mature and stronger, but also brings something new that is beneficial to the community. This has been the case throughout human history, in reality as well as in stories and myths. My own rite of passage involved no dragons, but still had plenty of challenges. I got a job at the age of 15 delivering groceries in a very poor section on the south side of Chicago. My parents knew I was working for the prosperous grocer who lived down our street, but they didn't know any real details of my workdays. On weekends, in a mixed ethnic, blue-collar neighborhood dominated by four-story old apartment buildings, I delivered huge boxes of groceries to very large families, mostly on the top floors, no elevators, and no heat. The deal that the customers got from the grocer was free delivery if they made a major purchase. In the overcrowded and very smelly apartments lived a real cross-section of post-war back-of-the-stockyard Chicago society. There were the dying elderly, the mentally retarded, the alcoholics, the crippled, many newly arrived to Chicago from everywhere. All of them were poor, with the maternal head of household very diligent and having to review every item in the weekly or two-week grocery supply. If I broke an egg, it was a shared tragedy. I spent long days struggling to get to their top-floor tenements. I hadn't known before this job that people lived like that, that this was often a dangerous part of town, a fact that never fully occurred to me, the witless young knight, but I reveled in having enough strength to carry boxes with bags piled on top, up narrow, dark stairways. I dealt hourly with parking hassles, talked police out of tickets, and foiled any attempts to either steal the owner's new Mercury station wagon or my enlarging roll of bills. All deliveries were cash. This experience opened my eyes. It changed me. I found that I could handle myself in difficult or dangerous circumstances. Of course, I look back now and see I really didn't understand how very dangerous it really was. If my parents would have known, they would not have allowed it. I guess parents of that time did not feel as protective as responsible parents do now. But as I reminisce through the lens of many years of personal experience, I recognize that it was well-timed to open me up to actively identify with the struggles and pathos I saw. And though I was just a high school boy delivering groceries in the inner city, this adventure incited me to do something more positive with my life than perfect my driving skills. So this rite of passage, exciting, enlarging, and fun overall, continues today in the passion I feel for bringing an enlarged view of play as a boon to others through this book. For all of us, entering the forest where there is no path and discovering our own path is an essential part of the transformative experience. The Outward Bound program is a good example of a program in which the risks are real but controlled, and the risks always feel much larger to the participants than the leaders. I've seen how such rites of passage can transform kids. One 16-year-old young man, son of my friend's, was a major concern to his well-meaning but stymied parents. This kid, Harry, was a very smart and pseudo-sophisticated couch potato, preoccupied with dark themes and video games, and drawn to ponderous existential literature, but clearly stuck in his juvenility. I had been active on the Outward Bound board and knew that the program then operative in the mountains of North Carolina was well-led, rigorous, and safe. So on my advice, Harry's parents enrolled him, with only mild resistance on his part. After a hearty breakfast, the group of 10 city-bred, co-ed 16-year-olds headed off for a distant campsite. They were carrying heavy packs with water, but no food. At about 10 a.m., Harry stopped, tired and hungry, and asked for food. The leader said, "Later, much later." For Harry, this was the first time in his life he had never been able to snack when hungry. Well, the day was long. Deep fatigue set in. But by about 4 p.m., they arrived at the campsite very tired and hungry. "Here is supper," announced the leader. "Build a fire and cook it." Whereupon a bag full of live chickens and a sack of potatoes stashed earlier were set in front of the group. Anarchy ensued, as no one had a clue how to kill and prepare live chickens. but hunger and fatigue overrode any reluctance to become primate carnivores. By about 7 p.m., the plucked chickens were on spits over the fire, and the famished group ate. This particular outward-bound tour, packed with unexpected and challenging, but doable, tasks, went on for 3.5 weeks, ending with an 8-mile run walk. Harry made it, completing this experience with a new, confident image of himself. He has never looked back. Now an accomplished triathlete and a medical student, he has been transformed. He credits the mentorship and direct involvement in nature, which began as overwhelming, but became fun, for providing the gateway to his successful early adulthood. Some parents don't allow kids the independence necessary for them to learn self-reliance. I've seen a lot of parents who still write their kids' research papers for them, and these kids are in college. Some of the kids graduate cum laude from top universities, but then are lost. They don't really know who they are because they have never found out for themselves. They are good at interacting with people because they know how to please. Their superiors and former teachers love them, but they feel empty and incomplete inside. There is one final potential transformation that adolescence brings about, but it is not in the kids. So much of parenthood is just getting by, making sure the meals are balanced and the schoolwork is done, trying to teach responsibility and generosity, right and wrong. But there are times when we pass on knowledge about what really matters in life, about how to look someone in the eye and shake their hands with confidence, about how to have vision, set goals clearly, and have the discipline to attain them. As we adults tell kids these things, we sometimes get a glimpse of our own best selves and how we might live our own lives better. Part of the joy and pain of being a parent is seeing our own parents in ourselves, seeing their good parts and flaws repeated in our voices. The joys and pain also come from seeing ourselves in our kids, and remembering our own happy days and hurtful traumas reflected in their experiences. If we are not completely full of ourselves or too serious, we can see that we can do a better job of helping our children be more joyful if we help ourselves remember how to play. If we are open to some self-evaluation and do so with a lightness about our life opportunities, we will actually find a way to play.
Chapter 5. The opposite of play is not work. A colleague of mine, Barbara Brannon, seemed to hit her stride in her early 30s. A human resources executive at hospitals and technology firms, she was promoted continuously for years. Happily married, she had one child and then another. As her children grew, she felt more involved in the community, and she began volunteering in a local food bank, became president of the PTA, helped rebuild the Colorado Trail, and became president of her professional association. She spent more and more of her time ferrying her kids to and from playdates or from one organized activity to another. She found herself having less time for the racquetball and skiing that she enjoyed. Just getting the groceries and laundry done on the weekend started to feel like a major accomplishment. She organized get-togethers with friends for drinks and marathon games of Trivial Pursuit, but these too began to feel less satisfying and occurred less often. After a while, she and her friends found themselves so tired that vegetating in front of a movie became the highlight of their downtime. Her social life consisted of talking with friends on the telephone, conversations that were filled with moaning about work, kids, the weather, and life. It shouldn't have been a big surprise when it all came crashing down. She injured her arm from overwork, and she began to feel a pervasive sadness that she realized came from an inability to live life with the joy she had had before. Jason studied fine arts in college and became fascinated by the process of making jewelry. He loved the design possibilities, the myriad materials that the jeweler could work with, the fine, detailed craftsmanship necessary to bring a design to fruition. He apprenticed to a master jeweler for a couple years, then opened his own shop in Palo Alto, California. Jason became enormously successful. He would work closely with people to understand exactly what they wanted, design the pieces himself, and then craft them out of raw materials. He was always thrilled with the process of helping people realize their vision, and then being the magician who conjured that dream into reality. But after many years, he began to feel a sense of incompleteness, despite the excellence of his work and the acclaim he received for it. He found that more and more he liked working with people, but the long hours alone in the shop began to feel like drudgery. The more he tried to ignore that feeling, the more the work felt like a burden. Eventually, he really didn't want to go into his workshop. He didn't want to look at jewelry at all, which is a severe handicap for a jeweler. Mark worked in a restaurant right out of high school and loved it. The owner was impressed at how hard Mark worked, but Mark didn't really feel he was working hard. He loved learning about each job in the restaurant and all its systems, and found he had a talent for suggesting changes in the kind of nitty-gritty details that are not glamorous but determine a restaurant's survival. Things like suggesting changes to the menu that lowered the plate price without reducing quality, altering the busboy schedule, and even changing the system for sorting and organizing trash and recyclables. Ideas that increased efficiency and profits. There wasn't any part of the restaurant that didn't seem interesting. Every part of the business presented a puzzle he could solve. At the same time, he felt that he was having fun, joking with the kitchen staff and the wait staff, goofing off in a way that didn't get in the way of the work and made the time fly by. Soon he was promoted, and then promoted again. As the owner put him in managerial positions with more responsibility, he began to feel that he shouldn't be joking around. He began to feel that it was his job to keep others from goofing off so they could get more work done. He felt that no one had any right to complain because he was working harder than anyone else. After closing the restaurant at 11 p.m., he would sit in the office for a few hours going over the bills, then drag himself home with no energy to even shower off the kitchen grease before bed, and then get back to the restaurant before 8 a.m. to supervise deliveries. One morning, he sat at his breakfast table drinking coffee and watching the second hand tick by on the clock. 8 a.m., then 9, then 10. He didn't feel sick, but was so drained that he couldn't imagine mustering the energy to get up from the table. The question that kept running over and over in his mind was so new to him that he thought he was the only one who had ever been stymied by it. But it was one that so many people ask eventually. Is this all there is? Each of these people, Barbara, Jason, and Mark, is an example of the critical fact that the opposite of play is not work. The opposite of play is depression. Our inherent need for variety and challenge can be buried by an overwhelming sense of responsibility. Over the long haul, when these spice of life elements are missing, what is left is a dulled soul. Far from standing in opposition to each other, play and work are mutually supportive. They are not poles at opposite ends of our world. Work and play are more like the timbers that keep our house from collapsing down on top of us. Though we have been taught that play and work are each the other's enemy, what I have found is that neither one can thrive without the other. We need newness of play, its sense of flow, and being in the moment. We need the sense of discovery and liveliness that it provides. We also need the purpose of work, the economic stability it offers, the sense that we are doing service for others, that we are needed and integrated into our world. And most of us need also to feel competent. Even people who are independently wealthy and never need to work a day in their lives find that they need to volunteer or donate to good causes to feel that sense of connection and purpose. The quality that work and play have in common is creativity. In both, we are building our world, creating new relationships, neural connections, objects. Even demolition or sandcastle smashing is a kind of creativity, since they clear the landscape, opening the way for new building. At their best, play and work, when integrated, make sense